Hello and welcome to this episode of DebtWired. I'm Laura Gardner, Deputy Editor of DebtWire Senior, and I'm joined today by Richard Cooper and Jim Ho, who are partners at Cleary Gottlieb. Welcome both.
Welcome, Laura.
Today we will discuss some New York legislation which has been getting quite a bit of attention from the sovereign debt community. So the New York State Assembly has three active bills which, if passed into law, could have a significant effect on how countries restructure their debt. The bills are backed by civil society campaigners which are seeking to defend countries in debt distress, but they've seen major pushback from private sector creditors. The legislation came very close to being enacted in early June and could still become law over the next few months. So, Richard, do you want to run us through what exactly the three pieces of legislation are?
Sure. Thanks, Laura. So, as you mentioned, there are three separate proposed laws, each of which could have implications for sovereign debt and sovereign debt restructuring. The first is a law to create a comprehensive mechanism for restructuring sovereign debt. The second relates to expanding the champerty defense that would be available to sovereigns to use against holders of sovereign debt. And the third provides for a limit or a cap on recovery by holders of sovereign debt in certain circumstances. By far and away, the law that has received the greatest attention is the first. That is the opt-in collective action type mechanism that seeks to provide a comprehensive solution to sovereigns seeking to restructure their debt. The way the law works is that a sovereign, if it elects to take advantage of the law, would file a petition indicating that its debt is unsustainable and it is working with the IMF to devise a path back to sustainability. The sovereign would submit a proposed plan to its creditors, and that plan, ultimately, if approved by two-thirds in amount and of claims, would bind holdout creditors in that circumstance to whatever the plan that's approved provides. The statute also appoints or provides for the appointment of an independent monitor who has to be approved by the sovereign and potentially a majority of the creditors. How that approval is enacted or affected is not clear. The statute also contains provisions regarding new borrowing, some of which are quite problematic, and we can talk to about that in the future. And it provides for a mechanism to allow the monitor to request a referee or a special master in the event that there are disputes. It's quite a comprehensive law. It has implications that we can discuss later to sovereigns, whether or not they opt into the statute, and potentially it can be applied retroactively to existing claims and indebtedness that have already been issued. The second piece of legislation is a more narrow statute, and it seeks to expand the availability of the so-called champerty defense that sovereigns could use when they are litigating against creditors who seek to litigate and seek to enforce on their debt. That defense, the champerty defense, prohibits a person, there's an existing law, section 489 of the New York Judiciary Law, that allows a potential sovereign to avoid litigation if the intent and purposes of bringing an action or proceeding, if someone bought a claim with the intent and purpose of bringing an action or proceeding on that claim. Currently, under the existing statute, that defense is available only for claims where the purchase price of that claim was less than $500,000. So it typically wouldn't apply in a sovereign context. As part of the proposal to expand the ability of sovereigns to use champerty as a defense, the law proposes to eliminate that numerical requirement. So that would be available to larger claims and could have an impact on the secondary trading market of sovereign debt. It makes some other changes as well, but that's the principal change that I think folks are going to focus on. And the third piece of legislation seeks to limit recovery on claims against sovereigns participating in certain international initiatives. It would seek to limit the recovery in sovereign restructurings to the amounts that would apply as if the U.S. government were a creditor and were acting under applicable international initiatives. And it enumerates what those initiatives are, largely initiatives that grew out of the COVID-19 pandemic and the like. That law that caps recoveries for creditors is a bit vague, and how it would be implemented and the circumstances in which would apply are unclear, to say the least.
So, okay, we've talked about the three types of legislation. You've mentioned a few issues, including lack of clarity. There's also some issues, I guess, around some unwanted effects. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on what these could be.
Yeah, we don't see the legislation as attractive for sovereigns or certainly not holders. So I think our view is that it's hard to imagine a sovereign actually agreeing to submit itself to the opt-in statute for a variety of reasons. One is that the law is certainly going to be challenged. There are a number of U.S. constitutional issues and the like, and those legal challenges are going to take years to sort out. Secondly, the law doesn't stay creditor litigation, whether it's in other jurisdictions or in federal court in New York. Third, our view is that even for countries that are not distressed, that creditors, investors are going to demand that either New York law not be applied and that for new debt issuances, the sovereign use instruments governed by the laws of another country or another state like Delaware. And that is going to introduce complexity for sovereigns that have most of their debt stock under New York law, or potentially raise the cost of financing as different jurisdictions are used in the case of new borrowings. So we think that the switching cost for sovereigns who have most of their debt stock under New York law, or the demands of new investors for sovereigns when they go to market to use the law of a different jurisdiction, are going to be quite costly to sovereigns. Frankly, we think it's going to be a burden and the wrong policy from a New York State perspective, and will result ultimately in the migration of sovereign borrowing away from New York. And that would be a shame from a New York perspective, but it would be costly, we believe, to sovereigns as well.
We can talk about migration and perhaps bring Jim in later for the English law perspective. But just staying on the New York side of things, what are the chances now of this becoming law? What are the next steps? Because we missed the June window. So what happens now, Richard?
Thanks, Laura. The legislature, I think, could take this up again in the fall. I think the market was surprised that there seemed to be some momentum for this legislature in May and June. And so it's possible that this comes back to life in the fall. At least from our perspective, we would urge lawmakers in New York to undertake a broader consultation with the market, with academics, frankly, with government officials at the Treasury and the like, all of whom have, you know, more experience than, you know, New York legislators in dealing with sovereign debt issues.
And thanks, Richard. Now, turning to the, I guess, English law approach to dealing with the issue of debt relief to sovereigns. Jim, I wonder if you could run us through what the UK courts have been doing, which is quite a different approach to what has been happening in New York. But I wonder if you could run us through some of the changes and approaches.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me on this podcast, Laura. So compared to the New York bill, the UK proposal is definitely in a much more preliminary form, or was in a much more preliminary form and in a much shorter form. So if you look at the history of what happened, the initial proposal came in the form of a report published by a parliamentary committee earlier this year. So it's the House of Commons International Development Committee. So in that proposal, the IDC noted that low-income countries are facing an imminent debt crisis. So we're looking at the effects of the pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and global inflation. These all place low-income countries' public finances under extreme pressure. So the report noted that a global effort is therefore required to deliver effective debt relief involving not only official bilateral creditors and multilateral institutions, but also the private sector. So what were the IDC's recommendations? Well, the IDC recommended that the UK government should consult on the introduction of legislation, not unlike the New York bill, to compel or incentivize participation of private creditors in the common framework, such as those proposed by the World Bank. Specifically, the IDC report highlighted two key proposals. First, the legislation should be introduced to prevent low-income countries facing debt distress from being sued by private creditors for a sum greater than those creditors would have received had they participated in the common framework. And second, the legislation should also be introduced to make debt restructuring agreements binding on all private creditors if the agreement is supported by at least two-thirds of private creditors. So compared to the New York bill, which empowers the New York state courts to supervise sovereign debt restructurings, the UK draft recommendation tilts more in favor of a contractual approach, albeit with legislative backing. So what the UK IDC parliamentary committee said was that, well, if the debt restructuring agreement is supported by at least two-thirds of private creditors, then it should bind everyone. And the UK government responded to the IDC report earlier this month in June, and they basically rejected both proposals. So at this time, the government's approach is that they should be focusing more on enhancing market-based or, you know, the contractual solutions to private sector participations in debt restructurings rather than introducing new legislation such as this. They explained that basically such legislation could be complex and could have unintended consequences, not unlike those that Richard mentioned earlier. And I think the main focus for the government has is basically that, you know, if you put such legislation in place, it could actually make it more expensive for developing countries to raise finance on the international capital markets. Pension funds, asset managers may be less willing to buy sovereign bonds if such a legislation is in place.
Jim, you mentioned that the government has rejected these proposals so far. Do you expect this will come up in some other way, or do you think it's the end of the road?
I think for now it's likely to be the end of the road, but it's definitely a hot topic that's being discussed by, you know, policymakers. So never say never, but it's just a watch this space situation.
Thank you. Okay, so I guess we've spoken about the different types of legislation and efforts that are being made to essentially address these issues of restructuring process, unsustainable debt burdens by from sovereigns. So they might not be perfect, but there's certainly some issues that need addressing. If these are not the correct solutions, I wonder what you think is a better approach. Richard, perhaps we can start with you.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Listen, I think we believe that sovereign debt crises are issues that are worthy of the thought of, you know, legislators, whether they're in New York or London. The issue that I think we feel is that in some respects, proposals made in New York are kind of a solution in search of a problem, and that it's the wrong problem. There is a problem. We have the IMF says there are 9 countries in debt distress today and 27 others at high risk. Many of these countries face mounting issues when it comes to food security, global warming, catastrophic climate events, and increasing poverty. These countries need, in fact, are more resources, both from the official sector and the private sector. The official sector will not be able to provide these countries with all of the financial resources they need. And therefore, the ability of these countries to access private capital is going to be critical in the years ahead to address many of the issues that they're facing. As a result, legislatures, and this goes back to something Jim said with the risks of legislation and the risk of unintended consequences, need to be very thoughtful when it comes to those unintended consequences, because of the impact of legislation is to decrease the ability of sovereigns in the emerging markets to access markets. That is going to be an issue. We think that there are different approaches to addressing that issue, the issue of expanding the deployment of private capital to these countries who are in desperate need of additional funding. We think that the official sector could be doing more to leverage its own balance sheet, to de-risk investment so that private capital can step up and meet these important needs. We think that there's the ability to tap into the ESG community to try to leverage the resources and the cheaper resources that community has when it comes to deploying capital to the benefit of these countries, whether they're in distress or they're just facing mounting expenditure requirements. Jim and I've done work for a group called the Bretton Woods Committee on Sovereign Debt Restructuring, and we're coming out with a paper in the next couple of weeks that highlights some of the ways that we think the official sector and the private sector could be working together to provide these additional resources to emerging market countries.
Thank you, Richard. It sounds like a lot of these topics were also addressed earlier this month in the Paris Financing Summit, and it seems to really the flavor of the month, I guess. So essentially, trying to incentivize private sector investment in these countries rather than trying to yield the stick against them, I guess. Jim, would you agree with what Richard has said, or would you want to add anything?
I completely agree with what Rich said, and this is also consistent with the UK government's response paper. So they basically noted that the focus shouldn't be on cancelling debt, but really solving the serious liquidity issue potentially facing developing countries. And what this means is that the countries need additional concessional financing from the international financial institutions and MDBs. And also policymakers need to think about how best to leverage private sector financing to help with this, right? So the idea, for example, of blended financing is has been around for a while. So things like AB loans and other sorts of structures like that can potentially be used and scaled up to help with the financing issues. And as Rich said, another flavor of the month is ESG financing. And this is also a key area that can be scaled up, especially in terms of ESG financing for sovereigns.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Richard and Jim. That's all we have time for. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning into DebtWired. Don't forget, you can download and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the OSphere platform. See you next time.